Shin Chaf Daled, Mitzvah 324, Mitzvah's Netilas Lulav. The Mitzvah to take the Lulav and associated species on Sukkot. Mitzvah's Lulav. Shenikach Beyom Rishon Shalchag HaSukkot Biyadenu Pri Eitz Hadar Kapos Tamarin Varaf Eitz Avos Varve Nachal. It quotes the exact language of the verse of the Torah that we're supposed to take in our hands. Okay, as opposed to in other parts of the body, although if you have no hands, so it says you take it in your elbow. You should try, you do, armpit if you have not even have an elbow. Okay, you do the best you can, but for most people, we take it with our hands. And you have to take these four species, and this is the language of the Torah, pre eats hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree. Some people say that hadar is the proper name of the esrog tree. And it's not, doesn't mean just the fruit of a beautiful tree. Kapos tamarim, hands of dates. What is hands of dates? Hands of dates is the palm frond, as we'll explain in a minute. Banaf eitz avos. Avos means, you know, thick. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the art scroll says plated, like a braid. Yeah, but the plated, implication plated, being actually. A...
plated, not plated. Okay.
Right, so plated. So it sounds
P-L-A-I.
That...
P-L-A-I.
Yeah. So it, basically the implication, ave in Hebrew means thick. Mm-hmm. It means thick with leaves. Mm-hmm. You know, we might translate it even as lush. Mm-hmm. Lush branches. Va'arvei nachal, and the willows of a brook. Oh, actually, a nachal isn't really a brook. It's a wadi.
Oh, okay.
A wadi is, things...
sometimes go dry, right?
Right. In the desert, in places like Israel, where the Jewish people are supposed to live, and what the Torah is really intended for, is... that the desert, there's a dry riverbed like, and then sometimes during the rainy season, so it fills with water. So that's a wadi. Shenemar says in the Torah, yeah, that's the pasuk. Mm-hmm. You should take it on the first day. Now, what's odd because the Sefer Achinuch doesn't say this explicitly, but there are actually two facets to the mitzvah. I mean, he discusses it later, but this is very important that that he should mention. He should mention it right off the bat. There are actually two distinct parts to the mitzvah, which is that the pasuk says, "Ulkachtem lachem bayom harishon," that you should take them on the first day, meaning that everywhere it's always a mitzvah on the first day of Sukkot to take the four species, and then it says, "Usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokeichem." Shivas Yomim. Then you should rejoice before the Lord your God, meaning with these species, for 7 days. So since the Torah divides the requirement into two, first you take on the first day, then you rejoice for 7 days. So this means that it's only in the Beis HaMikdash that the mitzvah of Lulav is 7 days.
Oh, that's how that works.
Right. But Midaraisa, the mitzvah of Lulav, is only on the first day of Sukkot outside the Beis HaMikdash. But as we know, once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the sages at the time, said that we should take the lulav for 7 days, so we shouldn't forget the idea that there is such a concept of the mitzvah lulav being 7 days. Yeah.
Now, it's only a mitzvah to eat matzah the first night of Pesach.
But
it's not a drabanan or anything like that to eat it the rest of the time. If you go,
that's a machlokes. Oh,
really?
That's
no.
A machlokes. No. Yeah, I mean,
is that analogous at all or no?
Well, no, because here there's a formal derabanan chiyuv that you have to take the lulav for 7 days. But for the matzah, the whole institution is deraisa. That the shitas that hold that you're supposed to eat matzah every single day for the entire duration of Pesach holds that it's a mitzvah kiyumis mideraisa. There's not an obligation. The only time there's an obligation to eat matzah is on Seder night. But according to the Vilna Gaon and others, this is not the simple understanding of most Rishonim, that when the Gemara says that the eating of matzah for the entire 7 days of Pesach is a rishus, is an option, it doesn't mean that you get no mitzvah points for eating matzah. It's just if you want to eat bread, so you have another choice, you eat matzah. According to the Vilna Gaon, it means that it's a mitzvah kiyumis, that it's not an obligation, but you get mitzvah points even if you, anytime you eat matzah during the duration of Pesach. Which is why some people are makbid to have shmura matzah the entire Pesach, because they assume that you only get the mitzvah points for the type of matzah that you would be eating at the Seder, which is the guarded matzah. which is a well, some people stam who are choshesh for the shita of the Rif and the Rambam, that lechatchila you're supposed to have shmura matzah the whole Pesach. That was the matzah that was guarded from the time of the harvesting. But others just do it because they think that they get more mitzvah points if they eat the shmura matzah the whole Pesach. But the truth is that that's difficult because we Ashkenazim, we don't paskin like the Rif and the Rambam. I think you know the Shulchan Aruch doesn't paskin really like the Rif and the Rambam. It goes like the other Rishonim in this matter, which is that technically speaking, the Shmura we even consider it to be Shmura Matzah for the Seder if it's guarded from the time of the grinding, not from the harvesting. Nowadays we have it available, so we get all the chumras, machmir, 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 which is what we should do. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Everybody says, el-chatchila, if you can get it. So for the Seder night, you should have a shmura mishas ketzira, which is matzah that was guarded, where the grain was guarded from the time of the harvesting to make sure that no water fell on it. But this was not always available, especially in Europe. And but it's not a European innovation. This is based very strictly on the Talmudic sources that the Rosh and many other Rishonim held that the type of Shmura Matzah that they had in those days, which was guarded from the time of grinding, not all the way back from the time of harvesting, was absolutely considered Shmura Matzah, and you could fulfill your mitzvah with that almost l'chatchila on the Seder night. So the truth is, So what's the other option? What's less than grinding? What's less than strictly speaking, non-shmura matzah, really not shmura matzah, is if you go to the store, you buy flour, and you bake matzah out of it. Okay, nowadays it's absolutely impermissible to go to the store and buy flour and bake matzah out of it because flour is tempered, which is that the vast majority of flour is actually soaked in water before it's ground to make it softer. So therefore, it's a shayla, at least, of chametz. So therefore, you absolutely could not use it to make matzah. But in the olden days, when they didn't always do this, they just they ground the wheat after not having soaked it in water necessarily. So b'shas etchak, you would be allowed to take, some say even for the Seder, it would be allowed to take this flour b'shas etchak. Again, not ideal, but in an emergency situation, you'd be allowed to take this flour, even for the Seder, and bake matzah out of it. And some say that for the rest of Pesach, it's absolutely permissible to take this flour. You don't need guarding at all, per se, from an earlier time than just the kneading of the dough for the rest of Pesach, as long as you're sure that's not chametz. If you don't have any...
You sell that kind of flour. You sell that kind of flour and yet b'shas etchak...
No. If you have really flour that was ground when the wheat was dry and was not soaked in water at all, then you don't have to sell that at all on Pesach.
You buy flour in supermarket.
Nowadays, flour you buy in the supermarket is at least a chashash, a concern that it might be chametz, and therefore it must be sold on Pesach
unless
and not kept.
Specialty.
But that's why, because it's only a chashash, even if it is soaked in water, it's not a guarantee that it will be chametz for sure. So that's why some people who are machmir not to sell chametz will sell flour because it's not even 100% clear that it's hard. But I'm saying to eat it on Pesach, for sure not allowed.
Exactly.
That's not a question.
Wait a minute. You said people who don't sell.
There's some people who, like, if they have pasta or they have a freezer full of rolls, so they won't sell that.
Full rolls?
What do they do? They get rid of it.
You get rid of all the chametz.
Oh,
whatever.
Yeah,
stuff.
I have a friend who does that.
No. They don't sell at all. So, and saying, or things like that, so they don't sell. But since this is only a chashat, because they're concerned, whatever, various concerns about the sale, that maybe it might be ineffective and they might be actually in possession of the chametz of Pesach, there is such a chumrah. So... but for flour, so some of these types of people who don't sell real full-blown chametz will sell the flour because it's only a concern of chametz, that's all.
Now, when the tempering of grain is only done immediately for grinding. In other words, so if you buy grain, you buy wheat and like that, and you're going to make normal matzah from the, and you're grinding it yourself, you don't have to worry that the farmer or whoever it was has soaked it beforehand because it probably would go bad.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's why you don't have to sell barley. If you buy pearled barley from the store, it's not chametz. Mm-hmm. It's just grain. Grain has never come into contact, as far as we know. You don't have to be concerned that it did. It doesn't look like it's starting to sprout or crack or ferment or anything like that.
Or green corn.
Right. So then you don't really have to sell at all because that's not chametz. Mm-hmm. It's not chametz at all. So what are we saying? So the so all the matzah nowadays. So nowadays there's no such thing as matzah. How do we go from lulav to matzah? Different holidays. Okay, both Jewish holidays. So nowadays there's no such thing as non-shmura matzah really, because all of the matzah that's produced in the world by commercial bakeries, I can't tell you there's no mishugana who buys grain and grinds it himself and makes matzah. Okay, or
involvement, more experience.
Fine, yeah. Okay, but normally all the matzah that's commercially produced is made from flour that shmura mishas tchina, which is washed from the time of grinding. So according to us, especially Ashkenazim, but again, even Sfardim who follow the Shulchan Aruch, technically speaking, all matzah is really shmura matzah. Just for the Seder, we're machmer on the earlier stage of shmura. That's what we colloquially call shmura matzah, which is shmura mishas kitzira. So that's why, finally answer our question, which is why I don't think that it's really reasonable to eat shmura mishas kitzira for the entire Pesach just due to this idea that you might get more mitzvah points. Because vis-a-vis this thing where it's questionable whether you even get mitzvah points in the first place, okay, we want to eat matzah during Pesach to fulfill the spirit of the holiday, and maybe you get mitzvah points, but to be makbid to get the super shmura matzah because of this, because maybe you don't get the points with a shmura matzah that we have nowadays, which is watched from the time of grinding, is a little bit excessive. So again, I'm very not into the hakpada of having shmura matzah the entire Pesach. And if you're super...
The hand matzah is always shmura.
That's just how they do it. Yeah.
I mean, because it's so expensive anyway. Why, you know? I mean, the additional cost of the grain probably is not, you know.
Right. Probably.
So if somebody only eats hand matzah, then for all Pesach they're going to be having, you know.
Yeah, I would like to do that actually, to found a hand bakery that bakes non shmura matzah, shmura mishas trina matzah rather. But I don't think there'd be such a market for it. I mean, I feel bad because, you know, I'm pushing this. Practically speaking, all the matzah that I eat on Pesach is shmura matzah because the bakeries that I like are producing shmura matzah. But, you know, I'm not actually makbid on that to the extent that if there were a bakery that I like that would be producing what we call non-shmura matzah, which is really shmura mishas trina, so then I have no problem with using that for the rest of Pesach. It's just a practical problem. Okay, but if anybody wants to, you know, invest in... start a new business, start a new matzah bakery where they're making non-shmura matzah.
I think that's called a niche market.
Yeah, it would, yeah.
According to what you're saying, any kind of matzah, even if it's not marked kosher Pesach, you can...
No.
I mean kosher Pesach matzah. Any matzah that's kosher Pesach, yeah. I mean, even the regular Manischewitz matzah, you know, the nothing fancy...
Streitz.
...is our Streitz. All these regular matzahs are shmura mishas trina. So what are these things? Oh, so what are we saying? So Beis HaMikdash, fine.
Lulav, yeah.
Right, so it's no egg in the Beis HaMikdash for 7 days, and outside of the Beis HaMikdash, Midaraisa, just the first day, but Midarabanan, we do it all 7 days. So the question is, what constitutes the Beis HaMikdash? So the simple understanding, as pointed out here by the Minchas Chinuch, is that the Beis HaMikdash means the real Beis HaMikdash. You have to go into the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, and there, once you're in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash with your lulav and esrog, so then it's a requirement to take the lulav and esrog for all 7 days. If you find yourself setting foot for any reason in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, which you're supposed to be doing on Chol HaMoed and during the holiday, so then you are required to take the lulav. So it's interesting. So that's not necessarily agreed to by everyone. So it sounds from the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayos, there's a famous Rambam that says that sounds like that all of Yerushalayim is called the Mikdash for this purpose. So it's some people are makbid to go to the Kotel every day of Chol HaMoed Sukkos with their lulav and esrog, so they have a chance, according to this shita of the Rambam, to fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa as opposed to outside the base of this area. Again, it would be outside the old city. It wouldn't be, I mean, not necessarily what we call town is the old city. Maybe it goes by the borders of Yerushalayim that were in the times of Bayasheni, where the wall was different. Wasn't exactly the same. But, you know, if you're in Har Nof, so that for sure doesn't count. It'd have to be in the borders of the old Yerushalayim. So that's the normal place where you daven in the old city, is the Kotel. So if you go to the Kotel, that's right by the Beis HaMikdash, as close as we can get to the Beis HaMikdash. So some people take the lulav and esrog there every day of Chol HaMoed Sukkos for the chance to maybe fulfill the mitzvah d'oraisa of taking the lulav and esrog for 7 days.
There's some idea, though, that for example, taking the lulav on Shabbos.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you were in Yerushalayim, where you were
supposed to... Oh, we'll get to Shabbos. Yeah, we'll get to Shabbos. Okay. Yeah, he'll mention Shabbos, 100%. But then you also get in the question that if you daven Shacharis on Chol HaMoed Sukkos in Har Nof, and then later in the day you take a family trip to the Kotel...
You can make a bracha.
Right, you wouldn't make a bracha because it's not for sure. Right. It's only a suffix. But the question might be that you might have to shake your lulav and esrig. Not shake it, but your yotzei b'diavadim just by lifting it up. Okay, but you might have to take your lulav and esrig again because ban har nof you were only chayev the rabbanon, and now that you came to the kotel, you might be chayev midaraisa. So that's something to keep in mind if you go to Israel or Yerushalayim for Sukkot, that you might have to be concerned that you have a different level of chiyuv outside of the old city and inside. Inside the old city area. Okay, uvaha perush. So how do we know what these species are? The Torah is a little bit cryptic when it describes these species. It sort of beats around the bush. It doesn't tell you, no, it should just tell us esrig and lulav and hadas and arava. Okay, we didn't have those terms exactly necessarily in the times of Tanakh. Okay, we have to have a received tradition about what these species are. Kipri eitz hadar. Ze ha'esrog, the fruit of a hadar tree, either a beautiful tree or the hadar was a proper name tree, is an esrog, which is a, how do you say esrog in English?
Citron.
So, in modern Hebrew, pre-hadar means citrus fruit. All citrus fruit is called pre-hadar. And so how do you know you can't use a lemon? Or grapefruit?
Well,
okay, Prehadar doesn't really mean citrus fruit in biblical Hebrew, but how do we know that it's a species is an esrog and not a lemon?
Actually, it's rather difficult. You know, I mean, I believe genetically they're essentially identical. Is that
not 100%?
Okay, no. I thought they're yeah.
No.
Oh, they're very different. I mean, well, I don't know how.
I mean,
exactly how close they are.
So tell me, how do you know that we're supposed to use a citron and not a lemon? Maybe you pick up a lemon at the store. This is close enough to a citron, close enough to an esrog. You know, it looks like sort of like it. You know, so how do we know? Received tradition. We have a received tradition about what is an esrog, that certain types of citrus species are considered an esrog, and certain types are not considered an esrog, and a lemon is not an esrog. And in fact, if you have no access to an esrog, you should not take a lemon, because then people might think that a lemon is kosher. So sometimes we have a principle that when you don't have the real mitzvah, so you should do the next best thing, because, you know, hey, what the heck, you know. Just keep the idea alive. But here, Yibedavka should not, because people could get confused and think that you could actually fulfill the mitzvah with a lemon.
And this is also where certain ones are better, because it's more likely that that kind of tree was used, right? All
the stuff. Yes. Now, the problem arises, excellent. The problem arises that there are many varieties of esrog that you'll find on the Jewish market nowadays, and some of them look very different from one another. So what's going on with that?
Different.
So how do you know? So maybe one's like a lemon. You know, a Moroccan esrog and a Yemenite esrog look different enough from each other that maybe you think that's the same distance between a lemon and an esrog. So how do you know that a Moroccan esrog and a Yemenite esrog are both good?
Lemonite.
Maybe one's not good. Maybe one's not really an esrog and one is an esrog. So the answer is it's a received tradition. The poskim say that the din of an esrog is similar to the din of a chicken. What do I mean by that? So, how do we know what species of bird are kosher? The Torah lists 40 species of bird that are not kosher, and the rest of the birds in the world are kosher. So how do we know which are kosher? Received tradition.
But you said,
so something that's accepted in the Jewish people as a kosher bird is considered to be a kosher bird. We are sure that... look, the Chazal do give us certain signs to how to identify a kosher bird. Because they had a received tradition about how if a bird has a certain signs, you know for sure it's not one of the 40 species. But we don't even rely on that, and we only eat birds that we have a received tradition that these types of birds are kosher.
Except for turkeys, of course.
Except what?
Okay, so an esrog is the same thing, that if something is received in a Jewish community as being kosher to use as an esrog, so then that is considered to be an acceptable esrog to use. Mm-hmm. During the course of the history of esrogim, there's been a lot of conflict about what actually is a authentic esrog. And part of the problem stems from the issue of grafting, that an esrog tree naturally is a very weak tree. So in order to produce, in order to make it easier to take care of and produce better quality fruit, so they used to, at a certain point, they started grafting branches of esrog trees onto other citrus fruits. And this created a major halachic uproar as to whether the product of the grafted trees was considered to be a kosher esrog if you took a branch of an esrog tree and you grafted it onto a different citrus fruit. So the Achronim say that, no, this is not, this, the whole issue was only mentioned in the halachic literature starting in like the 16th century. It's very interesting. But the poskim say, no, this is not an esrog. An esrog has to be 100% pure esrog and cannot be, have any admixture for different reasons, either because you, some say it's because you're not really supposed to graft, so since it, there was, somebody did a sin to create this esrog, so it's no good. Some say that because there's an admixture of the life force of the other type of fruit in the esrog, so therefore that doesn't count towards the required shear of how big an esrog has to be. So then it's less than the shear. But the normal reasoning in the poskim is that it's simply not a pure esrog, that in the esrog has to be a pure esrog as opposed to grafted to another and grafted to another tree. So then the question arises, okay, so we don't accept grafted esrog. But then the question arises, now you have a grafted esrog, and you plant its seeds. So is the, do the, and the seeds grow a pure esrog tree, not never grafted. Is that kosher or not? So some say yes, some say no. Some say yes because, not that they knew this necessarily, but the grafting does not change the genetics of the seeds. So if you take off the seeds and you grab, and you plant them and they grow a new tree, it will be genetically identical to the original esrog tree. It will have no admixture of the lemon genes in the future esrog tree. But others say no. Once the esrog has been contaminated by grafting by another fruit, its seeds are forever pusel. And if that seed, if that tree has, you know, grows, those seeds grow a tree, and then you take those seeds and they grow a new tree, the descendants forevermore are completely invalid to be used as an esrog.
Wait a second, though. I mean, is it sort of like Mamzeres? We're saying they have to have a chazaka to say, you know, if you know this tree's grandfather was an esrog, then you think, okay, you can't go back further.
Correct.
Than,
you know, that's why if you look,
forget it. They, you know, you wouldn't find a kosher esrog in the world, probably.
I don't know if I go that far. There's
no,
none.
No,
but
because as you said, if the pure esrog is weak, then it would have been crowded out, shall we say, by the ones that are, you know, that at some point, all you need is have to have, you know, some trees. Great-great-great-great-grandfather was grafted.
Right,
so that's why we assume that there's a chazokah. If you look on your esrog box, so normally it will say, you know, esrog bechezkas bilti murkav. The, it has a chazokah, it has a presumption of not being murkav. They can't tell you for sure, but we assume, okay, and halacha, that's good enough. However, so we assume one of two things. So in a place such as Morocco and Yemen, those two places, the esrog trees were constantly watched over by the Jewish community in those countries. And they made sure that there was no grafting going on. So therefore, we assume that Moroccan... people have different issues, okay. But based on the Gemara gives certain signs for what's an esrog. The poskim come up with certain signs for what's an authentic esrog. Okay, but these signs are... I mean, it has to, how thick the pith has to be, how it's shaped, all these different things. But again, the main thing is the Mesorah, the tradition. So again, there are going to be, you know, some people who want to create a tumult, and they say this type of esrog is no good, and this type of esrog is no good. But again, the main kashrus of the esrog is dependent on the Mesorah, on the received tradition. So in Yemen and Morocco, where the esrog orchards that were used by the local Jewish community were under a constant supervision, and if somebody, the people, when people came from Yemen to Israel, they saw grafting, like, what is this? We never heard of this. Grafting an esrog tree, they didn't even know how to do it. They had no idea what was going on with the grafting. So therefore, these types of trees that were under the watchful eye of the Jewish community the whole time, we assume are for sure good. And in Ashkenaz, in Europe in general, they generally used esrogim that were coming from Italy, which are called in the halachic literature Yanaver esrogim. Why are they called Yanaver esrogim?
From Greece?
No. Yanava is a Yiddish word for Genoa, the Italian port city, where the esrogim, they weren't grown there, but they were shipped out of Genoa. Okay. So this was the type of esrog that was used by the Ashkenazi community for many, many years. However, there weren't that many Jews in Italy, and there were people in Italy who were using citrons for the cosmetic industry and for eating themselves that were grown by goyim in the orchards. So for that reason, in recent generations, poskim have often recommended that when other options are available, so it's better not to use a yanav or esrog because you don't know their history, and the orchards were not under the supervision of the Jewish community. But others say no, especially chassidim. Chabad is especially known for the Samar also, one thing they agree on. Okay, that they want to use dafka, yanav, or esrog, because this is the type of esrog that their grandfathers, great-grandfathers used on Sukkot, therefore they want dafka, yanav, or esrog, and they claim that there are some orchards that they know for sure were not grafted, and good, so you have a yanav, or esrog.
Well, the second, let's say a chicken or a duck, after all, it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and so forth. You assume it's a duck.
Yeah.
It's like the whole thing with called Muscovy ducks or something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't a question of inquiring as to its ancestry. You say, look, basically what it looks like, it gives you the indication. Why isn't that the same thing essentially with an Ezra?
Because the signs are shiftier.
Oh, okay.
I mean, some say, the seeds have to be a certain way, and in Moroccan esrog, the seeds are the other way, and say in the same trees, some fruits will have seeds one way and some the other. I mean, because the signs aren't 100%.
Do Moroccans use Yemenite esrogim and vice versa?
I mean, Moroccan Jews like to use this type of esrog they're familiar with. Moroccan esrogim happen to be very beautiful. They usually have fewer defects, and they're more consistent, and they're very shapely.
You said if esrogim on the same tree can have different seeds.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be indication that they might have been grafted?
No, not grafted.
They have the same.
I don't know. I don't know all the botany of esrogim. I freely admit to that it's a complicated sugya.
Okay.
And others say that what's the best source of what's the real authentic esrogim? Where would you assume you would find the real authentic esrogim?
In Eretz
Yisrael, of course. That's what people used in the times of the whole Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael, but going back to Bayesheni and earlier, so that we assume that the trees in Eretz Yisrael bearing esrogim are the real authentic esrog. So how do you find a non-grafted tree? So here comes the Chazon Ish. So the Chazon Ish has a very interesting story about the Chazon Ish esrogim. So there were other strains of reliable esrogim in Eretz Yisrael. There's something called the Braverman. I don't know if you've ever seen it when you're esrog shopping. There's something called the Braverman esrog, which was used by Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, who was originally the rabbi in Brisk before the Soloveitchik dynasty kicked in. And he moved to Eretz Yisrael, so there was a certain type of tree that he relied on, which was cultivated by someone named Braverman, Rabbi Zelig Braverman, I believe. So a lot of people like the Braverman esrogim because they have Rishua Leib Diskin's hechsher, so to speak, on the Braverman esrogim. Okay, but they weren't maybe so widely available at the time, whatever it was. So the Chazon Ish moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he saw that there were esrogim in Yafo and other places that were being grafted. They're actively being grafted and were being sold to Chutz Laaretz now that there were more Jews living in Eretz Yisrael at the time. So people were very excited, when someone in Poland or Lithuania got an esrog from Eretz Yisrael. It was only something they could dream of. So they were, didn't care that it was grafted. It was a gorgeous looking esrog. It came from Eretz Yisrael. So the Chazon Ish was completely appalled by this. So he set out to find a more authentic version of an Eretz Yisrael dik esrog. And he claims to have found it. Apparently he studied some botany. And he had two versions, an early version and a later version, but the basic idea was he was wandering around in wild esrog fields, and he was examining the trees, and he found a couple species of esrog that he felt were really authentic, and they felt they had never been grafted, and he felt that, again, Chazon Ish, of course, was of the opinion that the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of a grafted esrog tree were a puzzle. Therefore, he wanted to find one that he thought was, it looked like it had never, totally been growing wild forever and had never been touched. Again, even then, you can't know for 100% sure, but that's what he assumed, and you can't go more than that. So that's why we have a couple different varieties of Chazon Ish esrog.
Would a genetically modified esrog be kosher?
According to this, no. It has to be 100% pure.
But, wait a second, though. Grafting, we know, is a something.
Not genetic.
Grafting afterwards.
That's worse than grafting. It has to be 100% pure esrog is the assumption in the postgame.
But except the DNA is something which halakhically, it's too small to see, right? So is that how can you, you know?
Yeah, but you did it b'yadayim. You did it on purpose.
Oh, okay.
That's like Rabbi Heineman and the Shabbos ovens, the Shabbos mode ovens. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Heineman holds that you're allowed to use an oven on Yontif. I'm not Shabbos. You're allowed to do an oven on. You're allowed there if you. It shuts off all the display, and you it has some sort of delay after you press the button. Mm-hmm. So everything is going on in tiny circuits in the oven that you cannot see at all, and you're allowed to raise and lower the temperature on Yontif in this oven, which obviously would be amazing. You can't see what temperature it is because the display is off, but that's why he holds that you're allowed to raise and lower the oven temperature on Yontif because A, he considers it a grumma, that there's some sort of delay after you press the button until the oven changes. That's considered to be an indirect action, and on Yontif we hold that gram kibui is mutter, that to cause something to go off is, you're not allowed to shut something off on Yontif, you're allowed to indirectly cause something to go off, and because that the action of the processors in the oven is not immediately recognizable to the eye, and not recognizable at all, it's a tiny circuit, you can't see what's going on. So for those two reasons, he feels it's permissible to raise and lower the oven on Yontif. That's why sometimes you'll find the ovens with a star K hechsher, and it says for Shabbos, Shabbos and Yontif mode, and for the Shabbos and Yontif mode, so the Shabbos is called Sabbath mode, so ordinarily on Shabbos it just prevents it from, you know, changing the temperature when you open and close the door, which is good, that's great, that's fine, but
why is that a problem? You're allowed to cook on Yontif,
yeah,
you're allowed
to
raise the temperature of the gas of the
yeah, but that's the problem, so some people. Right. So that's Shiloh, whether that applies to electricity, that some people say you're not allowed to raise the temperature of electric devices on Yontif because there are other things going on in the circuits besides a just direct raising of the temperature, and the also is lowering the temperature is a problem on Yontif.
Is it less problematic on the gas stove?
What do you mean? Lowering?
Know.
Lowering a gas stove is a whole separate discussion, but it's not permissible to lower a gas stove really either. So, okay. So the other thing. So he said that so Rabbi Heineman, so that's why everybody disagrees with Rabbi Heineman, because it's not a grumma and it's not not nira la'inayim, because you know it's what you want to do. You're pressing the button in order to lower the oven, and okay, there's a slight delay, but that doesn't count as a grumma according to most postkim.
If you don't know what temperature, what use is it to be able to?
Well, you you set it to 350 or whatever before Yontif,
yeah,
and then you keep track of how many times you press the button down, and you have to remember what. What temperature you set it at? So that's why.
Write it down. No, look at me.
Sure. So that's why. That's why kimat every rabbi in the world disagrees with Rabbi Heineman on this thing, and they feel that you may not raise and lower, at least lower, perhaps even raise the temperature
okay
of.
The rest of his kashrus stuff.
Yeah, the things that are regular kashrus is regular kashrus. Yeah. I mean, he has. I think I told you about this in the shir once, that he has this kula by Bishul Akum that a lot of people don't like. Which is that he has in the oven like a little light bulb that provides a tiny amount of heat, which is lit by the mashgiach and left there for a very long time. So he feels that obviates the problem of Bishul Akum when the non-Jew is lighting the fire in the main fire in the oven to cook the food, that since there's little light here that was provided, that provides a tiny bit of heat to cook the food, which is lit by a Jew, so that obviates the problem of Bishul Akum. So a lot of poskim don't like that either.
Is that different from a pilot light?
It's probably smaller.
Pilot light is also a shaila, whether that works. I remember I had relatives in Israel that they had a non-Jewish helper and maid. I don't know. So they used to light a 7-day Yahrzeit candle, and then in order to cook, this Filipino woman used to take a match, stick it in that fire, and light the fire on the stove. Mm-hmm. It's also very questionable whether that works, but you have. Again, so that is a problem. A pilot light is also a shiloh.
Although an actual commercial oven for bakery and so on, they never shut off. I don't think they're going to, you know, because of they take too long to come up to temperature. Maybe a certain scale you have to be before it does that. You know.
So that's very questionable. That's why some people. Again, I'm not trying to. My point of this discussion is not to chas v'shalom to bash. Right behind him in any way. He's a very big Talmud Chacham and very very honest, reliable person. I'm just giving an example that there are certain things that people don't like about it. So there are mitigating factors with a Bishul Akum that some people say there are more kulas if it's in a Jewish household. So maybe if it's a Jewish caterer, it would be applied the same way. That's why B'di Evid, so maybe you could eat the food. But But okay, that's what. But the general kasha is a very good hashgacha. I eat it myself. You know, the question would only be things that require a bishul akum and things that a bishul Yisrael rather, and this Shabbos oven business. You have to know what they hold about every issue. But I find that the Starkei is actually very helpful with consumer relations, much better than other hashgachas, which I think experience you had as well. So they're very open and transparent. They'll tell you exactly what's going on. If you say you don't want to rely on the skula, so they'll tell you. You say what products are made with this skula about the light bulb, and they'll let you know. But I find them very open. I was asking them, you know, questions about shchita that's under their supervision, and they're very open and very, very
open Orthodox.
No.
With the answer. So, you know, I rely on the hashgacha, and I know it's a good hashgacha. I'm just saying that with any casual organization, there are going to be some issues. So those happen to be, and we have to be very transparent about their issues as well, so that other people don't like these things. So, yeah, so that's what's going on with that. Okay. So the Esrogim with the genetic modification, so I don't think that would be acceptable, even though it's on a small level, because it's done on purpose. And we assume that it has to be a pure, 100% pure Esrog, descended from the Esrogim that were found in the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, Chazal, etc. So the Chazon Ish, Esrogim are relied on by a lot of people because they're assumed to be an authentic Esrog, because they were from the Esrogim that were grown in Eretz Yisrael. And they were selected by the Chazon Ish. So they say they grab onto the coattails of the Chazon Ish and Shamayim. If you know, they tell them the esrog you used wasn't really kosher. They say, well, the Chazon Ish said it was. Oh, okay, we'll let you off the hook.
The problem. Say Chazon Ish on them.
If it's the Chazon, yeah, I'll say on the box. Chazon Ish esrog. There are two types. There's a Lefkovich and a Halpern. It's two different types of Chazon Ish. So again, one is the earlier one, one is the later one. I think the Halpern is the later one, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, so if you want a Chazon Ish esrog, the problem is that they're oftentimes not very pretty. It's because they're so that's why people like the regular esrogim, the mass esrogim that are produced, and they don't look for, and also cheaper. The ones that are not the Chazon Ish are not cheaper, but the regular ones that you'll find in most stores and B'nai Akiva sells and all these things are what's called an Ordang Esrog, which are descendants of the ones that the Chazon Ish didn't like. That's why. Okay, so we assume that it's Bechezkas, not Morkov. Now, and as a descendant, if it's worse, it could be as a descendant of a Morkov one, and they're very gorgeous and pretty all the time. So the problem is they just don't have the Yichus. You know, I'm not saying they're not good. I'm not saying they're not good, but all things being equal, you know, it might be better to get one with some Yichus, if you can afford it, and if you can overcome the fact that there are often times the ones with ichus are not as utterly gorgeous as the ones that you'll find in the regular store. There's a funny story about the Chazon Ish. So somebody brought him a regular esrog, what we call an ordang esrog. Somebody brought him the ordang esrog, and he said, okay, Chazon Ish, we know you don't like these, but tell me, Lemaisa, you know, in a pinch, I want to know, is this esrog kosher? He says, yes, it's kosher. Yos is kosher af kompot. It's kosher to make kompot out of it. And he pushes him a little more, you know, say, okay, he starts being facetious, you know, b'shaz etchak, you don't have anything else, you know, meken machan a bracha aftem, you make a bracha on it. So he says, yup, bari pri haitz. Okay, right. Fine. So he was a bit extreme with his views about this. So obviously the vast majority of the Jewish people assumes that the Ordang Esrog is kosher. But again, I think that if you have a choice, so why not go with the ones that are have some more yichos, either because they were raised within a Jewish community in Chutz Laretz, that under the watchful eye of the Jewish community, or that were from the wild stock of Eretz Israel that had no shaychus to the new grafting business, such as the Chazon Ish, such as the Braverman.
But you shouldn't actually use an ugly esrog. I mean, isn't that certainly a big mile?
What
you know?
Well, if you want, huh?
Pre-Eitz Hador. What is Hador?
Yeah, it's supposed to look good. But again, our standards of what looks good as for an esrog are probably different, you know, than the olden days. You know, we're used to utterly, fantastically, perfectly gorgeous, and if you showed a nice Chazon-ish esrog to someone 1,000 years ago, they probably also would have thought it was very pretty. So again, you have different approaches amongst the Jewish community different members of the Jewish community as to which is the preferred esrog, but Lamaisa, practically speaking, any esrog with a mesorah that is used by the Jewish people is an acceptable esrog. Of course, you have the people who take more than one. You have briskers. You have briskers who aren't sure, of course. They're very nervous at fulfilling the mitzvah in the real, authentic way. So you have briskers who will take more than one esrog because they want to be sure that they got the right one. If the Chazanish one is really good, you know, maybe the Taimani is the real esrog, and maybe the Moroccan is the real esrog, and maybe the Yanaver is the real esrog. So they want to be sure.
How does that work? You can't hold them all at once.
You take one after the other. You take the lulav, and you make the bracha kayadua, as Rav Chaim said, on the prettiest one, no matter regarding the species. So you make because he's held that if you make the bracha on the, if you have an esrog, if you're choosing between an esrog that's for sure kosher and one that's and gorgeous, I'm sorry. If you have one esrog that's utterly gorgeous, but you're not sure if it's kosher at all, and one esrog that's but you know for sure it's kosher, so which should you make the bracha on first? Yes. And which should you take first? What?
The kosher.
Oh, that's what you think. That's what most people would think. But Reb Chaim Brisker famously held that you make the bracha on the pretty one first. Why? Because if you take the for sure kosher one first, then you for sure fulfilled the mitzvah.
You can't do
now that you take the prettier one, it doesn't help you. You're not fulfilling the mitzvah in a prettier manner. But in other words, so if you take the pretty one first, you're not sure it's kosher. So he held, you have two options here. Either you fulfilled the mitzvah in the most excellent way, that you took a gorgeous, gorgeous esrog, or you didn't fulfill the mitzvah at all. And then you put it down, you take the ones for sure kosher, in case you didn't fulfill the mitzvah at all. So that's why you should make the bracha. If you take more than one esrog, you should make the bracha on the prettiest, no matter what the species is.
Okay. There's a possibility you make the bracha twice.
No. Because you have it all in one sitting. You know, you
it's
take
like
the
Ravino Tom Phillips, sort of, you know.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Couldn't that get to be a bit expensive if you have to buy?
Oh, it can get very expensive. I mean, that's, very expensive. And the people who are doing it are the people who don't have the money.
I mean, in Europe, you know, one town was lucky to got one acceptable esrog at all. I mean, lots of times it was like a, you know,
Yeah, but they didn't know any better. They thought this is the esrog. Now with briskers, they live in Eretz Yisrael. There are all these esrogim on the market, but maybe this is the real one. Maybe this is the real one. So there are people who take many different esrogim. Okay. That's not the regular Jewish mahalach that we assume that any esrog, again, that has a mesorah is good. They asked the briskerov which esrog he thinks is the authentic esrog. He says, probably none of them are really good, but maybe a Taimani is a really authentic esrog.
How many kohanim did you use for pigeon event?
Oh, no, he was a Levi. He didn't make a pigeon event.
All right, well.
Oh, he got out of it. He got out of it right there. The Vilna Gaon Kayadu used many kohanim for pigeon event. Because he wasn't sure about the Ichos. Yeah. Same, very similar idea in Achinami. So the Ariskro famously once said that if he hadn't seen his father, Reb Chaim, make a bracha on Lulav and Esrog, he wouldn't have made a bracha on Lulav and Esrog because there's so many sveikas as to whether the Esrog that we have nowadays is the real Esrog that God had in mind when he told Moshe Rabbeinu to use an Esrog. So that's not, that's not the normative. If you ask me, it's not the correct Jewish approach that we believe in our Mesorah, that if we have a Mesorah that something is a good esrog, then it is a good esrog. But I do recommend that if at all possible, you get an esrog with some sort of ichos as opposed to just the regular standard kind. Although again, in a pinch, the regular standard kind is certainly good as well, and you can make a ruch on it.
Do esrogim trees grow in the desert?
Not the desert, per se, no.
So that the Jews didn't
there are all sorts of miracles then. You don't ask questions like this. Although there are, interestingly enough, that there's some esrogim nowadays that come from California. They're grown in California. There's a relatively decent-sized esrog operation where he has esrogim of all the different kinds. Yeah.
Anyway, the Midbar isn't necessarily a desert in our sense, but something without any water at all.
That's true,
too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the story with the esrog. What comes next? So the esrog, we've discussed what an esrog is. V'kapos tamarim hu'alulav. V'nichtav kapos chaser vav. That it says kapos tamarim, the palm fronds. It says kapos without a vav in it, which looks like kapas, like it's in the singular instead of the plural, even though it's obviously it's really the text of the verse is in the plural, to tell you, lirmos she'achiyuv she'nikach lulav echad velo shnayim v'shlosha o yoser. And we shouldn't take more than one lulav. We're only allowed to take one lulav. And if you add more, that's potentially a shayla of Baal Tosif, whereas he'll explain later that the other species you do take more than one. I mean, not the asterisk, but the other species you take more than one. Vanaf eitz avos hu hahadas. A myrtle tree is plaited or, you know, lush because it's a stick that's completely, you know, surrounded and covered by leaves. So that's why it's called anaf eitz avos. So it's a myrtle branch. Va'arvei nachal hi ha'arava hayedua b'Yisrael. And arvei nachal is a willow, which has specific halachic qualifications, that it has to have a red stem. Now, some of your aravos do not have red stems. The answer is that eventually, if they were not harvested so early, it would turn red, or it's from a species that normally has a red stem, in which case the red stem doesn't actually matter if your arava has a red stem or not. You could imagine that it's some sort of hitter that if you look, so I try to look in the package, usually they do have red stems, but I try to look in the package and see which ones have red stems. And it's supposed to be a long leaf that doesn't have strong, serrations in the leaf. It's supposed to be relatively smooth. If it has little serrations, like a lot of our arabas do, then that's okay. It just can't have very, you know, obvious serrations, which is called a different species that could be confused with a willow, which is called a tzaftzafa. Mm-hmm. Tzaftzafa has rounder leaves as opposed to elongated leaves, and it has stronger serrations. So it's interesting. The pasuk says arve nachal, the willows of a wadi. So the question is, maybe if the willow doesn't grow by a wadi, it's not kosher. Does your arava grow by a wadi? So the truth is that the accepted halacha is what?
Wadi is a dry riverbed. So does
sometimes dry riverbed.
Oh.
So the accepted halacha, what it says in Shulchan Aruch, is that this is just talking about the species. It's a type of species of willow that grows by a wadi, but the actual willow that you are using does not have to grow by a wadi in order to be kosher. However, this is somewhat subject to of a machlokus, that there is a minority shita that holds that it's not kosher unless it grows by a wadi. And there's an intermediate shita, which is that it's kosher if it doesn't grow by a wadi at all, but lemitzvah min hamuvchar, it's considered to be a hiddur, a preferred way to preserve the mitzvah, if the willow actually comes from a willow that grows by a wadi. So nachal, people, you know, in Europe and America, we don't know exactly really what a wadi is. We don't know from wadis. So when we think arve nachal, we think willows of a brook, translated something like that. So we don't have wadis here in America. So somebody once asked, the same Arba Minim person that I was referring to before, so he once asked an expert in these things, if the regular aravos that are on the market in America actually grow by a brook. Because he wanted to be mahadur, of course, to perform the mitzvah in a more beautiful way, to get the willows actually grow by a brook. So he said, he asked an expert, and the expert's name was Rabbi Avram Wright, who has a very good book on how to select the lulav and esrog, the lulav and esrog buying guide, it's called. It's nice, pretty English. Everybody should buy a copy and read it. Very easy reading.
Buy your books out.
Maybe they have it there. Anyway, so he asked him whether the willows nowadays are really arvei nachal or not. So he says, well, first of all, a nachal is not a brook. A nachal is really a wadi. Mm-hmm. So we don't have wadis in America.
Southwest we do, actually.
Okay, but we don't have willows. The willows that the Jewish community is using don't come from there. Mm-hmm. So he says, they're definitely not actually by a wadi, but if you want one that just grows by water, so yeah, the regular Muncie Aravos, you know, the ones that people get, do grow by a brook or some sort of water, so maybe that's good enough. Maybe when the Torah says Arve Nachal, it doesn't really mean a wadi specifically, it just means a willow that grows by a brook. So maybe you do get the hitter if it just grows by a brook or water. But if you want one that dafka comes from grown by a wadi, you're not going to get that. So he says, okay, fine. This is the best that's available, and they at least grow by some water. So we get all the the hitter potentially of a willow that actually grew by a source of water.
Now, in terms of baltosif,
yeah.
Generally, you have like the we call it sort of the hand, the plated
The koishikol.
Okay.
That's the koishikol, the lulav.
Yeah, yeah, the thing you hold the holder, whatever. It's called.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that's made out of the palm branch and everything, but. You know, it's something which is a kli. I mean, it's not something which seems to be very much out of place, shall we say. I mean, it always bothered me somewhat.
Yeah, briskers hold like you. They're machmer like that. But they don't use a koshigal.
I don't think the Taimanim use one either.
Right, Taimanim, they didn't have it in Taiman. It's a newer thing they came up with. So most people assume, no, this is just a beautiful way to hold the lulav and esrig. It's made of lulav branches, so it's sort of part of the same species. It's a great way to fulfill what we'll talk about later. The concept that ideally you're supposed to take it all in one bundle as opposed to separately. Oh. So according to most post-game, this is a great way to do it. But yeah, there are some people who want to do it the more original way, which is just to tie them together without any type of kli. But your shita is a minority shita, but if you want to be machmer like that, so you tie
it's very handy, you know.
Yeah, you tie your lulav together with an actual, with just string.
String?
Not, it could be string, yeah, but really? it could be a lulav. Yeah.
Wait a second, how can a string?
Because not a chatzitza, because it's designed to be for the beauty of the lulav.
Oh, okay, well that's good because normally when you buy them and they have these little bands on them, the bands come apart. So if you use a string, that'd be
So when I was in yeshiva, I saw some Rosh Yeshiva just tying the lulav together. So I tried to do it once because it seemed cool. And since then, I tried to use a koshikol, and it just doesn't feel right. I want to actually feel it, lulav in my hand. Not that I think it's no good, Khalila. I just, so since then, I usually just tie it together and actually hold it.
Well, the string of the
koshikol. Yeah.